And good morning and welcome to this June 6th, 2018 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. I'm your host for the first half hour, Marie Stone. Nicole Nelson will take over the airwaves for the second half. We're both doing what we do every single Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, about their process, about their craft. I'm here now with Sue Halpern. And coming up in the second half hour, Nicole will be on with Curtis Sittenfield for her latest collection of short stories, You Think It, I'll Say It. First up, Sue Halpern. She is the author of 7 books of fiction and nonfiction, including A Dog Walks Into a Nursing Home. Her writing has appeared in The New Yorker, The New York Times Magazine, New York Review of Books, Rolling Stone, and Condé Nast Traveler. Her latest is Summer Hours at the Robbers Library. It's published by Harper Perennial, and it's the subject of our chat this morning. Sue, welcome.
Hi.
So before we dive into the novel, I would first love to talk about your move into fiction. I know a lot of your work in the past has been nonfiction, kind of a mix of both, but fiction is such a different muscle. And I just wanted you to talk for a second about what compelled you towards fiction this time.
Well, you know, it's really interesting because when you write nonfiction, you're dealing with, you know, facts. And you're dealing with the real world. And obviously, when you're writing fiction, most of the time you're not. But it was my experience that some stories are just better told and asked to be told in fiction rather than nonfiction, because in some ways we're so inured to, like, reality that it just is better for the story to be made up and to have a kind of emotional valence that you can get when you're writing fiction that maybe you don't have when you're dealing with kind of real world stuff.
We always talk about how much sometimes easier it is to get to the truth of things in fiction than it is in nonfiction. When you're, you know, facts and truth aren't the same thing, and when you're constrained by a set of facts, it sometimes can be even harder to get to emotional truths.
Yeah, that's what my sense was, and part of this book came out of some of the nonfiction work that I was doing, and I had read this statistic that really struck me, and it was about how 2 years after people who had gone through spinal cord injuries and had become paraplegics often said that their lives were better, which seemed crazy to me, except that the numbers just kept on coming back. People would say that. And then I read over and over again people saying this about other traumas that they had gone through and had come through on the other side. And I thought, well, you know, it's possible to write that story by interviewing lots of people and they'll say, you know, this. But I thought it might be better and more compelling to tell the story of someone going through that process incrementally so that you don't necessarily bang someone over the head with it, like, hey, I feel better now, but rather, like, what does it take? What happens, you know, in this kind of day-to-day, inch-by-inch getting over something that was really pretty tough?
Yeah. Well, that's a good segue into letting you introduce the book for people who haven't yet picked up Summer Hours at the Robbers Library. Kind of take us into it and talk about, you know, kind of the scope of this world.
So I have 3 characters in this book who are very, very different and who meet at a public library in a kind of down-and-out town in New Hampshire, a kind of failing industrial town, kind of very different from the part of the world that you all are in, but I think you can imagine. And they end up at this library for very different reasons. And the main character, Kit, is there because she's got this kind of horrible situation that she's left behind, a marriage that she thought was solid and good that turns out to have had its major problems. And then she encounters in this library where she's the new librarian and she's come kind of to seek refuge. She encounters this young girl whose name is Sunny, who is a kind of feral child and who has been sent to the library to do her community service after stealing a dictionary from the Barnes & Noble at the mall. And she's been raised by these kind of off-the-grid hippie parents, and she's searching for something, but she doesn't know quite what it is. And then the third character is this guy who shows up and who looks different from everybody else. He's a refugee from kind of the financial downturn on Wall Street, and he's there kind of to seek his fortune in a kind of roundabout way. And these three characters who have nothing really in common form this pretty unlikely bond, and through this relationship with each other and through the other people at the library, kind of come out the other side stronger and better and with more kind of insight into who they are.
So tell me a little bit about, it sounds like the point of origin of the kind of the initial spark for you was this idea of people coming out of trauma, maybe, I don't know if the word is happier, but more satisfied or something than when they went into it. But that was that kind of the point of origin for writing it? Did it center first around the library and then the three characters kind of popped up from that? Did it start with a particular character that you were interested in? Or kind of tell me how you as writer got yourself into the novel.
Well, I would think I was thinking about Kit, and I was thinking about this idea that I mentioned before about people going through really tough things in life, and yet when they get out, when they can get through them, if they do, you know, having this notion that they're better off because they are more grateful and they see kind of the beauty in the world and that, you know, which carries them forward, whatever happened to them before. So that was in my mind, and I had done some stories, some nonfiction stories that kind of dovetailed with that. So that was there, and the other kind of kernel was that I had helped start a library in the town that I was living in. That was in a very rural, very poor part of upstate New York, and I watched how this library that we started on a total shoestring budget completely transformed the town and the people who lived in the town, and continues to do so, and just having a sense that libraries themselves are transformative places. They seem, you know, kind of benign and they're quiet and, you know, that sort of thing. But in fact, you know, when you encounter books and ideas and, in this case, people in that space, it can have a kind of, you know, radical effect on you. And so I wanted to put my characters in a library for that reason. And that library that we started on that shoestring budget, you know, now is just, it is the vital place in this community. And it transformed what that community even looks like physically, which is, you know, wonderful to see.
I think this transformation of libraries over the last couple of decades since the advent of e-books, or maybe it's people not reading as much. It's so interesting because I feel like some of them are making quite a comeback. I think some independent bookstores are making quite a comeback, and they're becoming a place where the community can kind of gather and hear, where the community can kind of come and heal. And there's a kind of homeless population that gathers at the library that we are. And it just feels like a very safe, kind of healing, accepting place, which, you know, all these people from all these various walks of life come, and they're all accepted and taken in. And it's the dynamic is really wonderful.
Yeah, that's the thing about libraries. And that's what we learned when we started our library, which is that it puts people in the same space who might never be in that same space, in a space together. So in the book, the space, the people who show up are these three characters, plus, you know, everyone else who's hanging out at the library. And that's just kind of a small representation of what happens in a library. And you're right. You know, you get people who show up, and what happens, at least what happened in the library that I helped to start, is that people start talking to each other. I was in there last summer, and kind of standing a little bit cluelessly at the new fiction rack, and someone yelled across the room, "Hey, you know what? You should read, you know, this book." And it was the book Homegoing, and I was like, "Oh, okay." And it was like, "I don't know who you are, but you think I should read it, so I'll take a flyer on it and I'll go get it. I'll take it out. I'll read it." And those kinds of conversations and those kinds of interactions that you have with people just don't happen in a lot of other places. When I was in graduate school, I was in graduate school in England, but I'm American, so I moved back to the United States, and I was living in New York, and I wrote my dissertation in part in the main reading room of the New York Public Library. And every day, these guys would come in. They had, like, been panhandling, and they came in, and they would, like, take whatever the change they'd gotten, and they would lay it out on the table with these books of, like, rare coins, like what, in, you know, looking possibly like maybe they found a penny that was worth, you know, $100,000. And it was just so funny. You know, here I was writing some, you know, pointy-headed dissertation, and there they were, you know, looking to see if they had won the lottery. It was kind of cool. We saw each other every day.
That's so great. My guest this morning is Sue Halpern. The book is Summer Hours at the Robbers Library. You are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM. I'd love to kind of unpack these very three distinct voices and kind of talk about your process for finding these voices for these very different characters, how they developed, who maybe gave you the most difficulty, and you know, kind of let's talk about these three a little bit more.
Sure. So the first character that came to mind was not Kit so much. I mean, I knew she was there, but I wasn't sure exactly who she was. So the first character that really rose up in my imagination was Sunny, the 15-year-old, somewhat feral child of the off-the-grid vegan hippie parents. And I think that's because I live in Vermont, and I also spent many years on the board of a kind of alternative school that perhaps had, if not children like that, because I don't think there were, but more like parents like that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, those are my neighbors. So it was, they were very familiar, and that was a kind of familiar, you know, kind of character. And I also thought it would be really fun to write that character. I love Sunny. She made me laugh a lot.
Yeah.
And then Kit, I knew some things about Kit. I knew she was kind of in hiding. I knew she didn't really want to engage with anybody. She really was feeling like she needed to kind of hunker down and just be by herself. And I knew that Sunny was going to be the instigator. That she was going to help Kit come out of herself, and in the same at the same time that Kit was going to almost, you know, without understanding it, going to help Sunny.
And she's the perfect character. I just want to interrupt here because she's the perfect character to do it because she's so young and a little bit naive and a little bit, you know, unaware of boundaries and what you're allowed to ask adults and what you're not. And
She doesn't know. She's like, I think at one point, you know, Kit says it, you just sort of have to imagine that Sunny is from, like, a foreign country, and she just doesn't know the customs.
Yeah.
You know, so she oversteps, but not in a creepy way. She's just such a sponge. She wants to know stuff. She's been so sheltered, you know, living as she has. And this is just this amazing opportunity that she just sucks up, and she becomes friends with everyone. There's no way that you can't like Sunny,
right?
Even if she's a little weird, there's just no way.
Right.
And so besides, you know, Kit can't, you know, she just can't avoid it, and that turns out to be a great thing. Like, you can imagine an adult trying to get someone like Kit out of herself, and you can imagine that it's not going to work.
Right.
You know, she would just push them away, but you can't really push away a kid like Sunny.
Yeah.
And then the third character, who I also knew was going to show up, but I wasn't quite sure, was someone who was also, I think, familiar not just to me, but sort of to all of us, because after the financial downturn in 2008, we were all kind of watching what was happening to people's lives, who thought they had it made, who thought they understood how the world worked, you know, the masters of the universe, and found out that their universe really wasn't as permanent as they thought it was, and found out that the kind of, you know, lives built on just acquiring money were lives built on a certain kind of quicksand. And so I think Rusty in some ways was familiar because of that. But I also felt like I was learning about him as he interacted with Sonny and with Kit and with the other people who were hanging out at the library. I learned more about him. He wasn't a stick figure. He wasn't a caricature. He was a real person. So we kind of watch him also become more real, because when Kit first sees him, she thinks he's that caricature of that Wall Street guy. And she makes all sorts of assumptions about him, which are really the assumptions that a lot of us made and make about people.
Yeah.
And then she can't keep doing that, because in part because Sonny makes it pretty clear that he's not the person that Kit is imagining him to be.
Yeah. So when you get into a character's voice, and all these voices are so distinct, do you stay with that character in the early drafts for a very long time and kind of unpack who they are? Or did you write this linearly and keep kind of switching back and forth between points of view?
I just kept writing back and forth, because the funny thing, and I don't know if this is true for everybody who writes fiction, but the funny thing for me is that they kind of become real. Like they have conversations in my head, and sometimes I just feel like I'm transcribing. At a certain point, they just kind of take on lives of their own, and so I just let that happen.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I would go back at certain points and do rewriting, but for the most part, it was very intuitive and almost visceral, just letting these guys kind of tell me what needed to be done. I know it sounds kind of weird, but that's just the way it was.
It's interesting you should say that, because I just came back from this writer's retreat, and we were working with this author who led us on this guided kind of meditation thing. And we had to really inhabit our character's body. And I think, you know, the first instinct is, you know, the show don't tell. The instinct is to just superimpose onto your characters what you think they would do, rather than really crawling inside their skin, really breathing their air, really feeling, you know, that their weight and all that stuff that makes them come alive. And I think that's the art of fiction, where nonfiction is an art too, but I think fiction comes from such a visceral, subconscious, other place than nonfiction work does. And it's just magical. I really think when you can crawl into somebody else's skin and you're almost taking on, you know, you're behind their eyes rather than looking down like God and saying, this is what this character would do. I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's very strange, because you end up feeling a little bit like a medium.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, oh. And I don't think it necessarily happens right away, but I think once you get going, it feels a little bit like those wind-up toys that, you know, kids have, you know, or did, anyhow. And, you know, you start by winding them up, and then you let them go, and then they just start, you know, marching across the, you know, the table.
Right.
It felt a little bit like that, which is very different from writing nonfiction.
Right, right. You know, one of my favorite characters was the therapist. Kit has a therapist that she goes to. And at some points I felt like, this is nice. I feel like I'm getting some free therapy.
That is so funny, because I gave this book to a friend of mine, a young guy, a couple of weeks ago, who had just gotten dumped by his girlfriend. And so I gave him the book because I thought it might help him, or at least amuse him, because I think one of the things we're not saying is the book is also funny.
Yes.
And so I gave him the book, and about a week later, he came over and he said, well, I'm doing some of the exercises that the therapist recommended in the book. And I was like, whoa, that is so funny, because I actually made those up. Like, I have no idea.
You did? That's funny.
I did. I made them up. And so, there is this, the one I didn't make up, because I think it's a pretty standard one, is, you know, write down things you're grateful for. You know, have a gratitude journal.
Yeah.
But, you know, in the book, what's funny about the gratitude journal is that kid is so opposed to therapy and to this, and so, you know, offended by you know, being asked by this therapist to find good in life, that she only writes down negative things.
Right.
Things she's really glad she's not, you know, that haven't happened to her. But I just thought it was hysterical that he sort of took it as a kind of literal, like, these are really good ideas of how to get over this breakup.
They are.
So,
I have to say they are. Yeah. Well, I had this conversation.
Maybe I missed my calling.
I don't know, because I was just having this conversation with people about how writers really are therapists, that if I wasn't going to be a writer, I'd be a therapist, because that is kind of what you're doing with characters. I mean, you're really trying to understand their psychology. And so I do think there's a little bit of therapist in every writer, to be able to really understand what motivates a character, what they're afraid of, what they want. You know, all those things are kind of therapeutic things. So I just love that there was a therapist in here kind of spelling it out for us, you know?
Right, yeah. I wanted the therapist to be a particular type, and, you know, very kind and gentle, but also a little bit, you know, just not letting kid get away with stuff. But, you know, their personalities were just so different, and so writing those scenes, those therapy scenes, I found quite amusing.
Mm-hmm.
They just made me laugh,
yeah.
Which is also good when you're writing. You might as well entertain yourself.
Right, right. And that makes it seem much more organic and authentic for the writer to be amusing themselves rather than being so plot-heavy and outline-heavy and here's what's the next thing that's got to happen. So that's, you know, it's always a good sign when you can make yourself laugh and cry while you're writing, I think.
When many years ago, my daughter was about 7. I was working on a book, and she said, it was a nonfiction book, and she said, why don't you write something that I want to read?
Huh.
First she said, actually, she's first thing she said was, what J.K. Rowling does is way harder than what you do. I was like,
nice.
Okay, 7-year-old literary critic, why? She said, because J.K. Rowling makes everything up, and you do a lot of research, and then you write it up. And that's very different. I was like, okay, that's true. So the next book I wrote was a novel. So I was like, hey, look, 10-year-old child, I wrote a novel. And she was like, that's nice, but why don't you write a book that I want to read? So then I wrote another novel for her age group. By then she was 12 when it got published, and that was good. And then when I came to write this one, I was like, I want to write a book that I want to read.
Yeah.
And that's why I wrote it. I wanted to read this book.
Yeah. She's tough on you. That's rough.
She's very tough. And I gave her this book, this one, and I realized the other day that we haven't talked about it, so I don't know if she read it, which is a little nerve-wracking.
Yeah, yeah, that's interesting. Well, that's a whole other topic. We're drawing down a little bit on our time, but I want to give you some opportunities now that you have all of these books under your belt, fiction and nonfiction, kind of some of the words of wisdom you can impart to our writers of kind of what sustains you or what you've found helpful in your writing life. Any words of wisdom you have, we'll take.
I think that find stories that matter to you, whatever they are, and let them tell you how they need to be told. I know that might sound odd, but I really do think stories do tell you if you listen, but really find stuff that matters only to you, because I think if it matters to you, then you'll be able to convince other people that it matters to them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's the only thing I can say, because I write both fiction and nonfiction, and I know that publishers sometimes want to pigeonhole you, but I think you shouldn't let yourself get pigeonholed, because it's not good for you, and it's not good for writing, and it's not even good for readers.
Yeah.
So, have a certain amount of self-confidence, which is always hard to have in the face of everyone telling you, you can't or you shouldn't. Just listen to the story.
Yeah. How many drafts did this go through?
Not too many. Oh, there's my dog. I wrote it. I gave it to my agent. And so we went through that. That was a draft. And then I sold it. And so it went through another draft with my editor, which wasn't much of a change. And that was that.
Wow.
That was it. It was pretty clean when I turned it in.
Yeah.
The first time.
It was meant to
and
be.
And I think, again, that has to do with the characters kind of being in charge of the story, as opposed to me kind of telling them what to do.
Yeah. Yeah. Sue Halpern, this was a huge pleasure. Can we stalk you online? I know you have a wonderful website.
I have a website, which I love, which was actually done by a guy in your neighborhood named Will Amato, and it's got this fantastic animation that we both thought was kind of just fun.
Yeah.
I've been doing a lot of journalism, I think in part just because of the political moment that we're in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And hope to get back to fiction when I feel like a lot of the pressing issues of the day aren't kind of demanding my attention.
We could have you on for a whole nother hour to talk about those, but
yeah, stay tuned. I mean, hopefully doing a lot of work around what's going on with the midterms and what's going on. I write a lot about technology.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
Stuff.
Yeah.
So, and how that interacts with kind of politics and society.
That's great.
I'm interested in that stuff.
That's great. Well, let's fight the good fight.
And I just want to give one shout out. I was just in your neighborhood and got to spend the day with the librarians of Orange County.
Oh, yeah.
Which was a great, great time.
The librarians are they're a strong and mighty group, and they actually put on the Literary Orange here that we do every year, and it's such a wonderful event. They're such champions of the written word, so that's very cool. That's very cool.
Yeah, it was their annual conference, and I got to come out there and talk to them and talk at them.
go libraries.
And, yeah, absolutely. Go libraries and go readers and go writers.
Go independent
bookstores.
That's right. Sue Halpern, thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Thank you. All right. Take care.
You too. That was Sue Halpern, the book Summer Hours at the Robbers Library. We are going to take a very short break. Nicole will be up next with Curtis Sittenfield. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. The show will join the other interviews up on the web and available via podcast from iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. You can always visit Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads as well as information on past shows and upcoming shows. I'm your host for this half of the show, Nicole Nelson. In the first part of the show, Marie spoke with author and journalist Sue Halpern. Next up, Curtis Sittenfield. Curtis is the best-selling author of five novels, including Prep, American Wife, and Eligible. Her books have been selected by the New York Times and other publications for their 10 Best Books of the Year lists, optioned for television and film, and translated into 30 languages. Her short stories have appeared in The New Yorker, The Washington Post, and Esquire, and her nonfiction has appeared in The New York Times, Vanity Fair, The Atlantic, and on This American Life. Her first story collection, You Think It, I'll Say It, was recently published by Random House. She was on the show a few years ago to talk about her novel Sisterland, and I recently spoke with her to talk about her new collection. I began by asking her to introduce the collection.
So it's 10 stories, and if I'm sort of joking around and someone says, what's the book about? I say it's about grouchy Midwestern women, but it kind of is. I mean, it's about other things too, but most of the stories, I think three of the stories are from, you know, a couple years ago or maybe 5 years ago or 8 years ago, but the bulk of the stories I wrote like within the last 2 years. And I think there is a sort of element of, you know, some of them take place against the backdrop of the 2016 election, or they're about marriage or parenthood or friendship and female competition and social media and celebrity. And yeah, how's that?
That's good. And I've heard you say elsewhere that you have an interest in characters who are smart but wrong.
Yes.
And
yes.
So I want to hear more about that wrongness and the conflict. And is that conflict where the story begins for you, or?
Well, so I think that it was relatively recently that I had this sort of self-discovery where, you know, like I think it's a through line or a common theme across stories for me that I'm not that interested in telling a story about a person who's, you know, not that smart, whether they're right or wrong. Like, I think often, I don't know, like if a writer self-consciously makes a character less intelligent than he or she, the writer is, a lot of times it just sort of comes off to me as patronizing or mocking of the character. But it's also like I think to tell a story about an intelligent person who's correct about their own understanding of their life or their assumptions about the world is also weirdly not that interesting. But I do think there's something about telling a story about a person who's like sort of competent, you know, the person's not a disaster going through their life, but they also do have some fundamental misunderstandings about themselves or about other people.
That's interesting. I've also heard people talk about the point in stories where someone does the right thing for the wrong reasons or the wrong thing for the right reasons.
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, I don't think that's like the lens through which I see the world, but if I did, I think I can see that would be one of those things where I start saying like, yes, that's an example of that.
And speaking of smart characters, in your story Gender Studies, I would love if you would read to us from that story.
I would love to read to you. Okay, so this is the main character is a professor. Her name is Nell. She's a professor of gender studies at the University of Wisconsin, and she has traveled to Kansas City for an academic meeting, and she's in her hotel. With CNN on in the background, Nell hangs her shirts and pants in the hotel room closet and carries her doc kit into the bathroom. The members of the governing board will meet in the lobby at 6 and take taxis to a restaurant a mile away. Nell is moving the things she won't need at dinner out of her purse and setting them on top of the bureau, a water bottle, a manila folder containing the notes for a paper she's in the revise and resubmit stage with, when she notices that her driver's license isn't in the front slot of her wallet behind the clear plastic window. Did she not put it back after going through security in the Madison airport? She isn't particularly worried until she has searched her entire purse twice, and then she is worried. She also doesn't find the license in the pockets of her pants or her jacket, and it wouldn't be in her suitcase. She pictures her license sitting by itself in one of those small, round, gray containers at the end of the X-ray belt, the headshot from 2010 taken soon after she got reddish highlights, the numbers specifying her date of birth and height and weight and address, but she didn't set it in any such container. She probably dropped it on the carpet while walking to her gate, or it fell out of her bag or her pocket on the plane. Can you board a plane in the United States in 2015 without an ID? If you're a white woman, no doubt your chances are higher than anyone else's. According to the internet, she should arrive at the airport early and plan to show other forms of ID, some of which she has, a work badge, a gym ID, a business card, and some of which she doesn't, a utility bill, a check, a marriage license. She calls the airline, which feels like a futile kind of due diligence. The next call she makes is to the van driver, thank goodness for the $20 tip, who answers the phone by saying in a professional tone, "This is Luke." "This is the person who is your passenger to the Garden Center Hotel," Nell says. "You dropped me off about 45 minutes ago." "Hey there." Immediately, Luke sounds warmer. Trying to match his warmth, she says, "I might have left my driver's license in your van. Can you check for me? My name is Eleanor Davies. I'm driving now, but I'll look after this drop-off, no problem." Impulsively, Nell says, "If you find it, I'll pay you." Should she specify an amount? Another 20, 50? "Well, it's here, it's not," Luke says. "I'll call you back." "I was sitting in the first row behind you," Nell says, and when Luke speaks again, he seems amused. He says, "Yeah, I remember."
Thank you.
You're welcome.
That was Curtis Sittenfeld reading from her new short story collection, You Think It, I'll Say It, published by Random House. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. And in that brief section, I like when she gets this thought about money and should she pay him, how much, and then his response to that. And just regarding characterization in the confines of a short story, can you talk about how you approach characterization or any challenges you run into?
So I think that I've sort of been thinking about this question in a slightly different way, because something that I take as a really, I feel weird about this compliment, but some people will say to me, since this story collection has come out, I don't usually like stories or story collections, but I like this one. And I feel a little like, well, you should like story collections because there's a lot of really great stories, and maybe you just haven't found the ones that are, like, you know, right for you. But then I also think, well, if you're saying you enjoyed my book, thank you. But I think about, like, I think one of the reasons that people, if pressed, will say they don't like stories. Obviously, this applies to, you know, they're passionate story lovers, so this does not apply to everyone. But they'll say almost like, I have to kind of, like, relearn all these characters, or, like, it's hard to get invested, and then by the time I do, if I do, the story is finished. And I've been thinking about, insofar as some people say, well, I like your story collection, I think, this is sort of a long, convoluted answer, but I think that my characters are flawed, and, like, in many cases, they sort of transgress or misbehave, but they're also vulnerable. And I think that that vulnerability makes them sort of real and endearing to the reader unusually quickly. And so, for instance, in the section that I just read, like, that's like a little ways into the story, but within the first paragraph, you've already found out that Nell has been left by her partner of more than a decade for, like, a younger woman. And so Nell is this, you know, she's in some ways, she's like a prickly person, but she's also a person who's been hurt in this very serious way very recently. And then she's kind of like almost like accidentally or semi-involuntarily like following her ex-boyfriend on Facebook and, like, you know, seeing the details of his elopement with someone else. And so I think that I one time read that, like, essentially the way humans form friendships is, and especially, like, authentic friendships, is one person kind of exposes herself, and then the other person exposes herself similarly or doesn't, but if she does, then you sort of move to another level, and you kind of, it's kind of, I'm trying to think what the word is, like, it sort of builds on itself or something. or intensifies. And then I guess the reverse is true, that you can, and I think in life, like I've had friends where we've sort of soul-bared and become really quick friends. And then I have friends who I like, but it's been a relatively superficial friendship for like 10 years or something. And so I think that these stories are more like the fast friendships where you sort of know a lot about someone relatively quickly.
That is interesting. I can relate to that too in terms of friendships. With Nell's character, can you talk more about developing her with those things in mind? How conscious was, for example, the fact that her relationship had recently failed, or just constructing her complexity?
So I actually think of stories in terms of structure. I went to the Iowa Writers Workshop for grad school. I finished a long time ago in 2001, and my advisor was the writer Ethan Kanan, and he would talk about the structure of stories, meaning essentially, like, what happens, what order does it happen in, how does the writer reveal information to the reader. You know, like, a story is usually a bunch of scenes, and a novel is usually a bunch of scenes, and so, like, what happens in those scenes? And so I kind of think of it in these very almost mundane ways, like, here's the character, like, she's physically in an airport shuttle, and then she's going to get to the hotel, and then she's going to realize that her license is lost, and then, you know, she's going to go to this dinner, and then she's going to see the shuttle driver again because, you know, she thinks he has her license. And so actually almost everything that's more emotional or subjective bubbles up on its own while I write. And, like, I think I'm aware of certain opportunities for, like, tension or conflict or juiciness ahead of time, and that's why I've chosen the scenes that I have. But I don't really think to myself, like, I need to develop this character more, or I need to inject some social commentary about politics here. Like, I'm just kind of, like, you know, crafting the structure.
And how about dialogue then? Because, I mean, the title is You Think It, I'll Say It. And some of the stories are maybe dialogue driven, and it's so full of conflict and characterization. And can you talk about techniques that you might have to get the dialogue to do that work, and also how it sounds authentic?
So again, I think that I'm a, it's such a weird thing to answer these questions. I mean, these are like intelligent, reasonable questions. And a lot of what I do, I think, is very instinctive, and that's why I'm a writer. And so in some ways, my answer to a lot of questions about specific choices I make in my fiction is that it's like, you know, getting dressed in the morning. And if I said to you, why are you wearing the shirt that you're wearing right now? Either you would say, I got up in the morning and I put this on and it seemed fine, so I kept it on. Or it would be like, I got up in the morning and I put on something else and it didn't seem quite right, and so I changed it. And maybe that didn't seem quite right, so I changed it again. And then I arrived at, you know, what I'm wearing right now, where I feel like, you know, definitely I write stuff and it turns out on the page, like, it's like corny, or if it's dialogue specifically, it's like unrealistic, and then I just kind of rework it. But I don't feel as if, like, a lot of it is a little bit intuitive, and it's not, I mean, I just kind of, like, I sort of think about the way people talk, or I like, find eavesdropping interesting, and, like, you know, I'll sort of mimic things that I may have really heard, or, like, conversational patterns, but I don't. It's more like I just try it and it turns out okay, or it doesn't turn out okay.
I hear what you're saying. So you have instincts that you follow. And I'm also thinking back, frankly, to something you've talked about with regard to plot. You've referred to plot, I think, if I'm remembering correctly, as a muscle that you can come to a juncture, and if you don't know what's going to happen, make a list of five or I forget how many things, and then, you know, take it from there, and that with practice making plot evolve becomes easier. First of all, is that accurate?
Well, I don't know if I said that. I don't remember saying that, which doesn't mean I didn't say it, but I also think that sounds like reasonable advice. So either way, I'm in agreement with that statement, whether or not I said it.
Okay. So now I'm afraid to ask my next question.
Oh my God. No. You can ask anything you want. It's just like, I sometimes feel like I'm not able to give a completely satisfying answer. Or like if I asked someone else something and was like, well, how did you do that? And the person said, well, I did it. Like I did it by doing it. I'd be like, that's not useful.
Well, I've read that you'd like short stories and that if you had to choose between short stories and novels, you would choose short stories if you can only do one.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that short stories are famous for is being difficult to end.
Mm-hmm.
And so, however it makes sense to you to talk about endings, there was this advice that I thought was really interesting that came up once in the context of ending a short story and what not to do. It's that if you get to the point where either A or B must happen, then you can't do, you know, you can do neither A nor B, but you have to do something else. And I was thinking of the do-over in that context, because you have the characters are having this intense conversation about, and one of the main points is, are they or aren't they going to see each other again that night?
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, that is resolved, but that's not, it doesn't end up being the real point. And it's a satisfying ending. And so I'm just, can you talk maybe particularly with that story or just generally about endings in short stories?
Yeah. So, well, one piece of advice that I think is sometimes attributed to Flannery O'Connor, although I don't know if she really said it, but it's at the ending of I don't know if it's a story or just any piece of fiction, you know, obviously including a novel, should feel surprising yet inevitable. And I do feel like that's like such a beautiful and wise phrase, because it's true. Like, you want to feel like you didn't see it coming, but, you know, now that the story unfolded this way, it's exactly as it should have unfolded. There's something kind of magnificent about that. So that's a piece of, you know, like writing wisdom that's been rattling around in my head for a really long time. Like I'm sure I first heard that when I was in graduate school. And then actually my editor at Random House, whose name is Jennifer Hershey, said something to me recently where I had written, I mean, essentially this is like a sort of nitty gritty publishing tidbit, is I turned in the book and I think there were 9 stories, and my editor and I subsequently pulled one of them. But when there were 9 stories, she almost for publishing reasons, frankly, she said, or for like sort of sales reasons, she said, I want you to write 2 more because I want half the book to be previously unpublished. Because essentially, if you, and I agree with this as a consumer, that sometimes there are story collections that come out, and if I feel like I read 6 of the 8 stories in The New Yorker, I won't necessarily buy the book. And so I actually wrote Plausible Deniability and Do-Over. Like, I felt like they were sort of stories that were inside of me. I don't know if I would have written them at that particular moment, but I wrote those because she said, okay, I want 2 more stories. And at the time that I was writing those, she also gave me this feedback that I almost thought to myself, I can't believe I've never heard this, which is, she said the end of a story should feel like, instead of it tying things up in a neat and tidy way with a bow, it should actually feel like it's sort of opening a new door. And I think that actually I sometimes have an impulse to over-resolve things, and I just thought that that was a really good way of thinking about it. And I did rewrite, one of the stories is called The World Has Many Butterflies, and I rewrote, like I almost feel like the original ending was almost like this editorial summary of like, this is the emotional state of the character, and it's much more open-ended the way it's published.
Moving on to talk about short stories generally, I am interested in hearing you talk about what other short story writers you enjoy.
Well, my favorite writer is Alice Munro, and I, you know, like have read her work. I first read one of her stories when I was a junior in high school, and you know, loved her right away. Although it's interesting to kind of grow up with her, and I'll read a story now, and it reads really differently. In fact, there was a story, one of the early stories I read by her, which is called Goodness and Mercy, and it's in the collection Friend of My Youth. I thought that it was a really beautiful and romantic story, and there's like an older man and a younger woman, and they don't have a conventional romance, but there's this sort of undercurrent of romance between them. And I reread it recently, and I was like, this to me now is not a romantic story, although I think other stories she's written are like beautiful and romantic. It's like not like a positive romantic story, but I love like the complexity of her people. I love the complexity of her plots, like her ambition, her fearlessness in subjects that she tackles. And I just think she's like an incredible, you know, brilliant, devastating writer. I feel like there's like two writers whose names I kind of don't know how to pronounce. One is Antonia Nelson. A. Nelson. Anyway, I like her story. I think probably my favorite collection by her is called Female Trouble. But she's a really interesting writer. And then also, it looks like Caitlin Macy, but it's called Cash. I think her name is pronounced Cashlyn Macy. And she had a story collection called Spoiled, maybe 8 years ago or something, that I think is really excellent. I love the stories by Andrea Lee. She, I don't think she's had a story collection in the recent past, but, she's written a lot of stories for The New Yorker over time. So, and some men too. I like Matthew Clam. I feel like he's like another fearless writer, and he's also really, really funny.
I'm going to return to something that you were talking about earlier, which was the point when your editor said, we need two more new stories. And you said, you know, they were in your mind and they might not have come out at that moment. Do you keep a notebook of ideas, or do you just let your brain take care of it? Or how do you catalog these ideas that you're, you know, amassing in your head?
So I think the answer to your question is yes. Like I do sometimes take notes. And then sometimes I like lose the piece of paper that I took the notes on, and then I find them and I think, oh my God, like there's, you know, this is my next story. I should have been more careful with this. And then sometimes I do, like sometimes I'll be in some particular situation. Like I'm trying to think of an example of this. Like maybe this is a hypothetical example, not a real example, but let's say I always like, you know, go to the same grocery store, and there's some idea I had 3 years ago that could involve that grocery store, then I probably always think about my idea for that story when I'm there. And like over time, it's almost like it's just kind of simmering on the back burner. But sometimes I'm more organized than other times. So right now, speaking to you, I have a office inside my house in St. Louis, Missouri. And I have, if I'm really organized about it, I'll take notes, like if I have an idea, probably just like on a piece of paper. Like I kind of have a notebook for like a year at a time, and it'll be like, sometimes I'll use it for grocery lists, sometimes I'll use it for fiction ideas, sometimes I'll use it to like take notes at student teacher or parent teacher conferences for my kids. But if I write down notes for a story idea in that notebook, then I'll rip it out and put it in a manila envelope and like label the manila envelope, and it'll be like, you know, grocery store parking lot story. And then I'll just like put it, and I can see it right now. Like I can see sort of stacks of folders, and you know, I might write one of them a week from now. I might write one of them 6 months from now. I mean, I'm lucky as a writer because, essentially, I guess this isn't desirable to every writer, but I sign contracts for books before I write them. And so it has two implications. One implication is that essentially my default responsibility professionally is that I always should be writing a novel. But it also means, like, I'm not really in a position where I think to myself, I've got to write something. What's an idea? For me, it's more the opposite. It's more like, I have this idea. this is or isn't an appropriate time schedule-wise to write it, but I want to.
Well, Curtis, we're drawing down on our time, and we like to end the show with writing advice from our guests. And so do you have any points of inspiration or any words of encouragement for our writer listeners?
I mean, I think, of course, there's like so many tidbits and, you know, very few of them are original to me, but I think it's like write the thing that's most interesting to you, like write the thing you want to write. And I don't know, because it's I think usually that generates better writing. And if it doesn't, at least it like holds your interest while you're working on it.
Well, Curtis, thank you so much for being on the show.
My pleasure. Thank you. Thank you for all the questions, even the ones I didn't satisfyingly answer.
That was author Curtis Sittenfeld. Her new short story collection is You Think It, I'll Say It, published by Random House. That's all the time we have for today. Until next time, thanks for joining us. Have a great day.